Hello again, everyone. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to Bartley's commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. I thought I'd discuss a few issues. My thoughts on the Miami Mall incident. I'm absolutely certain that something other than kids fighting and fireworks or firecrackers caused that ruckus, which resulted in either the serious injury or the death of a young man. First of all, the whole notion of firecrackers and fights or that's a non-starter. Something extreme made those people run off in a blind panic. These weren't just a bunch of people that answered a Craigslist ad for crisis workers. If you see the expanded, zoomed-out video, you see people running in blind panic. And the kid who got run over, late teens, probably young adult, he and his friends were fleeing, sprinting. They were already safely out of the mall. Gotten by the police cordon outside of the mall, and they kept running. And I saw the video; it was horrific. And this kid sprints into the middle of the street without looking, and he is absolutely smeared by a driver going probably over 60, closer to 70 miles an hour. My guess. He was going way too fast for city driving in Miami. I don't know what they drive like over there, but in a built-up city area, it's completely irresponsible to drive that fast. At any rate, the kid ran into the street. He was smeared by this speeding motorist. The kid went flying out of the screen, out of the picture. My guess is he may have been dead before he hit the ground. His friends ran over to check him out, but that was the end of the video. And then you see the other video, which I'm sure some of you have seen by now, and it shows the side of a portal opening up. This is the side view. And to use a term borrowed from Stargate SG-1, the event horizon is the space, for lack of a better term, within the Stargate portal ring, whatever the case may be. In this case, CCTV camera in the Miami Mall, Bayside Mall, I think it was called, caught the side of the portal, which was better than catching the front of it, in my estimation, because not that I give a rat's ass what these skeptics and debunkers and blue beamers think, but if it was a frontal shot or frontal video of a portal and an entity's coming out of it, these wise guys and ne'er-do-wells would just say that it's all CGI or something or Photoshop or something. But this is a little harder to fake. What it is a thin line. A thin dark line out of which you see energy coming out. And behind a thin white line, there is, from the other side of it, seems to be like an entity or something that came out of it. The eyewitnesses were telling things which, from an alien, non-human life form, cryptid research perspective, I'm stumbling over my words today. Makes a lot of sense. The skeptics were going, well, these witnesses were saying the creatures were like glitching in and out. That's just CGI. That's just a hologram. No, they can make better holograms than that. What they were describing was something that many eyewitnesses have seen. Cryptozoologists are familiar with this. Certainly, alien investigators are familiar with this. Some entities, when they're in our reality, they can, for lack of a better term, glitch in and out. Or sometimes parts of them, not even all of them, but parts of them can be translucent. You can see through them, or conversely, you can see into their innards in some cases, but more often, being able to see through them, transparent, or you see through them in some parts of the body, other parts of their body seems to be corporeal. Likewise, the way the entities moved, they seemed, according to the eyewitnesses, to slide over laterally. They would slide forward, slide laterally, and sometimes they would disappear and reappear, but closer to the percipient. The ET sliding thing is a well-known fact based on observations. Betty Andreasen's account in the Watchers saga, the Andreasen Affair 2, the Watchers 2, etc. In one of her experiences, which came out under regression, she said one of these
ETs floated right to her. Not so much floated, I take it back, glided towards her, just kind of approached her with without its legs moving and without its feet touching the floor or floor of, I can't remember if it was a floor on board a ship or it was in her in Betty's house. But at any rate, this entity just kind of slid towards her without even touching the floor, it seemed. Again, these little nuanced answers that people give. They didn't say that these tall beings were taking long strides and lunging toward them. They said they were glitching in and out, and after they'd glitch and reappear, they would be closer to the witness, the terrified witnesses. And some of them seemed to move laterally or slide forward or slide laterally. So these are key points to remember. It's not always what comes out in the image or the video, it's the eyewitness testimony. You go back to that terrified gal on board the airliner screaming about how the person next to her wasn't a real person. That's not acting. That gal was terrified. Likewise, all the people fleeing from the mall in Miami, that was not some kind of FEMA drill gone wrong. Forget about the dozens of cop cars. Just for a moment, just look at our fellow humanity just fleeing this mall in blind animalistic panic. This is just beyond flight mode, fight or flight. This was beyond that. This was fleeing in blind panic to the point where someone just runs blindly into a street long after they were safely away from the mall, in my estimation. I mean, I wasn't there. And man, the poor guy was run over. And they've since tried to muddy the waters. For those of you who were watching some of the subsequent videos that came out, they kept conflating this, to me, possibly CGI video of this thing on all fours crawling insect-like across an intersection, right? And people were saying in these videos, oh, this was taken of the ET at outside the Miami Mall. Nonsense. I'd seen that video sometime before, months or years before. I really didn't take much notice of it because it could have been CGI. I didn't really have any interest. And then when you look at the reaction of the drivers, first of all, that's nothing like what we see on the videos of Miami. You see the roads blocked, you see the roads jam-packed, that avenue there, jam-packed with cop cars. So this notion that these cars stopped like at a red light and they're just patiently waiting for this critter on all fours like to saunter across, that doesn't even jibe with the video footage of Miami because we didn't see that. We saw no civilian cars. We saw the whole, just about the whole street taken up by cop cars. Okay? Nobody was sitting there parked essentially at an intersection waiting for a critter to pass. That's not what happened. But yet, time and again, that image, which some of you listening to what I'm talking about, kept showing up in these videos where they're talking about the Miami Mall incident. That's an example of muddying the waters, clouding the issue, giving the skeptics and debunkers something to chew on, essentially. And then there's other video outside where this gal took this video. She did something to the image. Either reduced the amount of light or did something to it, did a contrast. But clearly, you see this very tall being moving along there amongst the cars, the parked cars. And what they try to do, what the frauds and debunkers try to do, they took a video. I don't know if the video was ready-made or still images. If it was, if they're ready-made, which if that was the case, it's very suspicious. Of this big, clearly fake inflatable, I guess ET, right? And it was like being inflated, and it was there in front of some building casino looking place. I really can't say, what the back building in the background looked like. But presumably, we're supposed to think that it's the mall, right? Now, again, that doesn't match the witness testimony. First of all, they inflated that doll, that big alien doll, outside of the mall, okay? Outside of the mall. That's not was what was making the people flee from the inside of the mall to get outside. It wasn't this big inflatable alien that they were trying to flee from. That's just silliness. It's a non-starter, a non-sequitur. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't follow, right? And then you talk about the video that I just mentioned, where the gal did the contrast or whatever to the light, amount of light on the video, and clearly it shows some kind of very tall critter there. So that's my thoughts on the Miami Mall incident until proven otherwise. Yes, I would have to say, based on the witness testimony, oh, and the fact that the first witness who came out, he was made to recant, retract, said he hoaxed the whole thing. But then other people came on after him, and a lot of the activity, or at least some of the witnesses, happened to be by a shoe store. So there are correlating aspects of the reports, a pattern data correlation. Now, what were the entities doing there? Because, like I said, until proven otherwise, I'm going to go with what the witnesses said and what the video work of that one gal who, like I said, she did something to the lighting, reduced it, whatever, to show the critter behind the glaring lights, and then the massive police presence, the power outage. It's standard operating procedure for the feds and especially for crash retrieval units. In the past, they've gone by names like Project Pounce, the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, or the IPU, Moondust. Moondust's official story, official role was to recover space debris, conventional space debris, but chances are they were used for other things as well. Point being is that if they need to create a blackout, a power outage, to facilitate the removal of an alien craft, alien wreckage, bodies living and dead, they will do that. If they need to set up roadblocks, if they need to pretend there's a huge chemical spill, they'll do all of that and more. First, they try to spin it out and say there wasn't no power outage, air travel wasn't shut down, but the power outage has been reported by a lot of people. And like I said, it's standard operational procedure for the feds or black op units to create a power outage if necessary. In fact, the retrieval units are trained in just that. It's not to preclude the possibility that those ETs themselves were responsible for the blackout. I'd like to know what they were doing there. To me, there's a number of possibilities. One, the ETs, interdimensionals, the subterrestrials, all of the above. Who knows what these critters are or where they came from? All we know is that they were rather large by normal human standards. Did they come there of their own volition? Okay, let's just open a portal, step through it, and scare the hell out of these people. Or did they come through, but it was an accident, like they intended to go somewhere else? Now, it should be noted that there's a lot of spookiness involved with a number of, lack of a better term, shopping malls, not only in America, but in other places. Some of these malls, especially the big malls owned by these multinationals, they have underground tunnel systems big enough to drive lorries through, big rigs. Now, the passageways and underground road systems are as big as what people describe in the underground bases, the DUMs, so-called deep underground military bases. To me, chances are the tunnel systems beneath these malls, some of them, probably connect with the underground deep black military aerospace tunnel network, maglev network. Also, if you recall, I had a guy who went by the name of Matt R. R is the last initial, who talked about when he was in New Orleans prior to Hurricane Katrina. You know the story, they blew out the locks and they caused the hurricane with weather manipulation to double back, right? After it had safely passed the Florida Peninsula, somehow it decided to pretty much do a U-turn, come back. And the winds, despite the damage it had caused, the winds were not strong enough to cause the mayhem and catastrophe that we saw in New Orleans. They blew out the locks as they'd done before, and it flooded out, memory serves, the lower Ninth Ward. But point being is that in the weeks prior to that, Matt R., who I debriefed and who I'd had on my show before, talked to him privately on a number of occasions, he says he was there in one of the malls in New Orleans, and at night there was training going on between what he perceived to be, and my memory may be failing me, memory serves. I think he mentioned something about the National Guard being there. Could have been a cover, could have been people wearing National Guard outfits, or a deep black spook element of National Guard elements, and we know that exists. Classic surface level example is 20th Special Forces Group, which was attached to the Alabama National Guard, which played a key role in the CIA-Contra drug wars. So we know that some of these National Guard units can be, elements of them can be used in what we would call clandestine or covert operations. But at any rate, if memory serves, Matt said there were elements of the National Guard there, law enforcement there, and he said that they were there with reptilians. And these reptilians, and I hope I'm not conflating his story with other stories people told me of reptilians carrying personal weapon systems, but I think if memory serves, Matt said these reptilians were carrying these backpack type outfits, which allowed them to shoot some kind of a plasma gun or a ray gun or something, and that they were training my labs as well as elements of the National Guard and law enforcement and probably deep black military in the use thereof of these devices. And one could presume to be for some possible civil unrest scenario. And Matt said this had been going on for weeks leading up because he was being abducted and taken to this place by his handlers, his controllers. And he witnessed this himself. And I don't have any reason to doubt that because many abductees, myself included, we have very vivid dreams, quote unquote, or actual full-on conscious memories of being at what appear to be malls. Now, to be sure, I do believe some of the malls we see in our dreams slash experiences could be simulated to look like malls, especially I think sometimes the big multi-story malls that we find ourselves in these dream astral dreamscape consciously recalled or flashback memories, that some of these big multi-tiered malls may be a screen or a cover for the interior of a large craft or some alien installation. That is possible. But I also think that some people are literally describing malls at night. And it could be beneath the malls or it could be inside the malls at night. Because remember, malls, all private security. Some of them have very spooky connections. Some of these, I bet if you track far enough back, you'll find that some of these companies like BlackRock, that they have a controlling interest in some of these malls. And we've heard the stories about Walmart and their possible role in the FEMA Rex 84 lock up all the dissidents, so-called scenario. So we know that malls, big warehouses, Walmarts, etc., can potentially be used for this kind of thing. I myself have had very vivid dreams of being in a food court in a mall at night with other people, presumably other abductees or my labs. And there were other occasions when I had dreams and or memories or flashbacks of being in a mall at night, being trained or something. And I'm not the only one. There are other people who describe the same thing. Many alien abductees describe being taken to malls by ETs and being trained there, and also my lab controllers taking them to malls. One last bit about malls is we can't forget that certain malls, there was one in Salt Lake City, if memory serves, Crossroads Plaza. I can't remember the name of the place, but I heard a lot about it. And they've since torn this mall down or did a major renovation to something else now. But at any rate, the night staff at this mall back in the day in Salt Lake City, security, cleaning staff, etc., they kept having frightening encounters at night in the mall with reptilians. It seemed that the mall was situated atop, or at any rate, accessible to a reptilian lair down below it. And always remember, reptilians, when they come up from underground into a home, a business, into a shopping mall, whatever the case may be, they don't necessarily go through an opening in the ground through a doorway, a hatch, a hole in the floor. Often as not, they will open a portal. That's a key point to make. This is what David Eckhart talks about and many others. But my friend Lorena Smith saw many times. Portals would open up, these entities would come out. What did we see in the Miami Mall? And this had happened for a while. People were quitting their night jobs. They didn't want to work there at night. They didn't want anything to do with the mall, even during the daytime after they had those experiences. I heard a similar story from a guy in another country who said that he and his sister had gotten lost walking along the catacombs of this mall, and they stumbled into this one room, big room, and then they had a reptilian encounter. So it's not something that's relegated strictly to the USA. Looking back to the reasons why these ETs were there, did the ETs or whatever they were decide to go there purposefully? Or secondly, did they go there by mistake? They wanted to go some other place or maybe some other entire realm, but they made some kind of mistake and went there instead? Or were they sent there? Were they somebody's mercenary, so to speak, or someone or something's foot soldiers sent them there? Or, and this is possible too, this is within the realm of possibility, did deep black elements of the military associated with aliens, because of all these long-standing by now treaties, plural, not just a treaty. You always hear people talk about a human alien treaty. No, I think that there are treaties, multiple, plural. So could a advanced military group have sent those ETs through that portal to scare the hell out of those people? I'd like to know, personally. It is entirely within the realm of possibility that the deep black military could have sent those aliens there for whatever reason. That kind of makes a whole mockery of the blue beam concept, because as my dear listeners know, and many people out there know, there is an ongoing interaction between deep black elements of the military, aerospace, and medical community with, for lack of a better term, aliens, or at any rate, non-human life forms, either off-worlders, interdimensionals, subterranean beings and civilizations, etc., etc. It's possible that those beings were sent there by somebody to wreak havoc, or at least, at any rate, to scare the hell out of people. And they did a great job at that. Okay, I'm going to change gears a bit and talk about Majestic 12, talk about the Atomic Energy Commission, talk about the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project, and the slippery slope which led inevitably, predictably, I would argue, to Dulce, China Lake, El Yunque Forest, Puerto Rico, Mount Hays, Alaska, Sedona, and other places, Kirtland Sandia Complex, Groom Lake, other places where there has been, and in some cases, still ongoing interactions between non-human life forms and humans. So how did it go from the late 40s to fast forwarding to the point where humans and aliens are side by side working in unison in some of these facilities? How did that happen? And I would argue, and I'll elaborate on this more later, that the thing was definitely a setup, set up as a Trojan horse with the intention of creating what seemed to be a mutually beneficial alliance at the time to the human participants. To be sure, there were probably adepts and warlocks on the human side of things, seemingly on the human side of things, that knew better and knew which way the whole alliance was headed towards, burgeoning alliance. But then there was many people that had no clue. They were flying by the seat of their pants. They were put almost in an impossible situation, having to deal with the enormity of the alien presence in their midst, in our midst, and how to deal with it. Deal with it without being overwhelmed, overtaken, utterly destroyed in the process. It was not an enviable job, I'll tell you that. There was an interesting cast of characters in Majestic 12, as well as
the committees and the individuals that made up the committees beneath MJ-12. Everyone from General Leslie Groves, the wartime head of the Manhattan Project, and he became the head of the post-war successor to the military army Manhattan Project. That was the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project at Sandia, which I've talked about before and I'll talk about again. You had Jerome Hunsaker, one of the world's leading aeronautical engineers, had been deeply involved in military aviation and particularly naval aviation and setting up the industry, setting up the internal infrastructure in order to create and develop better airplanes, better engines, better airframes. Hunsaker was a world-class expert on aerodynamics and aeroplanes. Then you have an individual like Dr. Theodor von Karman, Hungarian expert in aeronautics, befriended General Henry Arnold before the war, before World War II. Theodor von Karman came to Caltech as the result of a Guggenheim Aeronautical Laboratory Fellowship grant that was arranged by the Dean of Caltech, Robert Millikan. Robert Millikan was a good friend of Henry Arnold, who later became Chief of Staff of the Army Air Forces when Henry Arnold was stationed at March Field, Riverside area of Southern California. Arnold decided he needed insight into where air power was going to be, and Arnold was looking not 5 years ahead, 10 years ahead. He wanted Theodor von Karman to think 50 years ahead, 100 years ahead. Where is air power going to take us? So Arnold made Dr. Theodor von Karman the head of the Air Force Scientific Advisory Board. And it had another name change, Air Force Scientific Advisory Group. And you can see in some of these majestic documents, they specifically mention the involvement of members of the Air Force Scientific Advisory Group, referred to as AFSAG or SAG in some of the documents, the acronym. And it specifically mentions some of the majestic documents, Dr. Theodor von Karman examining alien technology, alien wreckage, alien reactor systems, along with Oppenheimer. And it was Theodor von Karman who wrote Where We Stand, and he wrote Beyond Horizons. And these were classified at the time, and probably still parts of it are still classified white papers, essentially, that Dr. Theodor von Karman and his team of some of the top aeronautical engineers, rocket scientists, et cetera, the report that he came up with projected air power far into the future. His papers were talking about pilotless, what we call now drone attack planes, but he was talking about swarms of them. He was talking about airborne armies, not just an airdrop of a regiment or a division or even big airdrops like Arnhem, September 1944 in Holland, but much bigger than that because the capability of airlift and air travel would have progressed so much by then. I'm going to read now from documents I found on the Majestic website that the father-son team of the Woods have carefully constructed over the years. What's interesting about the documents is that there's a lot of confusion and a lot of perplexity about the nature of the recovered technology. Over and over again, you read statements in these documents about the lack of conventional wiring, the unknown nature of the fuel source of the reactor. Everything was a big mystery to the people that analyzed the technology. It was so far beyond what they had become accustomed to. And remember, as far as they were concerned, the powers that be, the United States was the leader in aerospace, along with Great Britain, aerospace development. And then here they are examining this recovered technology, and it's just a real head scratcher for them. They can't make heads or tails of some of the technological finds. I know that there's many people, some of whom I have a lot of respect for, are somewhat dubious about the Majestic documents. I can't speak for all of the documents because I have not perused all of them. There's a lot of them. But the ones I've zeroed in on and have read and studied, I don't see anything that would suggest they are a hoax. In fact, the personnel that are mentioned were right for that time and period. They didn't pull these names out of the hat. These people were the best in the field, their respective fields. Whether the organization was called Majestic 12, MJ12, or some other name, they would have put together, it only stands to reason, they would have put together this august body of men from a variety of fields that relate directly to aerospace, outer space, space exploration, research and development. They had the opportunity to canvass the whole military industrial complex system and draw from it the best and the brightest, so-called. And a lot of these people had extensive experience working in classified projects. General Hoyt Vandenberg, for example, was not only a wartime Air Force leader, actually leading bombing missions against the Axis countries, but after World War II, he became one of the leaders of American intelligence as a leader of the Strategic Services Unit. He actually inherited a large part of the OSS, Office of Strategic Services, that had been disbanded by Harry Truman. For a time after World War II, Hoyt Vandenberg, General Hoyt Vandenberg, was G2, head of intelligence for the War Department. Back then, prior to the National Security Act, there was the War Department, which handled, oversaw Army operations and development, logistics, infrastructure, etc. And then you had the Navy Department. So after World War II, Vandenberg became head of G2, of all of Army intelligence. And of course, back then, the Army Air Forces was part of the Army. And Vandenberg was the second director of the Central Intelligence Group after Rear Admiral Sidney Sowers. Rear Admiral Sidney Sowers played a key role during World War II and prior to World War II, putting together the infrastructure of naval intelligence. Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter, the third director of Central Intelligence, was a field agent, a naval attaché during World War II. He was actually in Paris when the Germans occupied Paris, providing up-to-the-minute field reports. So we're talking about people that had deep experience not only in research and development, but in creating standalone, highly secure, compartmentalized intelligence operations, intelligence, research and development operations. The aforementioned Rear Admiral Sidney Sowers became the executive secretary of the newly founded National Security Council under President Truman. In fact, he was a close friend and associate of Truman's, card-playing crony of Truman's. So we're talking about extremely well-connected, deeply influential people in the fields of aviation, intelligence, research and development. And in some other show, I'll go into detail about the backgrounds of Rear Admiral Sidney Sowers, General Hoyt Vandenberg, Roscoe Hillenkoetter, etc., because one could learn a lot just by studying the backgrounds of these individuals. The first report I will read is a field report from the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit. The IPU was formed by General George Marshall, who became later on Secretary of State, and also apparently General MacArthur in Japan also was advised of the creation of the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit and had some role in the creation of it. Probably the only thing that Generals Marshall and General MacArthur actually ever agreed upon, if you study the dynamics between those two individuals. So this is the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, and this is their report. classified top secret ultra intelligence assessment. The extraordinary recovery of fallen airborne objects in the state of New Mexico between 4 July 6 July 1947. The summary was prepared by Headquarters Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, Scientific and Technical Branch, Counterintelligence Directorate, as requested by Acting Chief of Staff G2 at the express order of Chief of Staff. And the Chief of Staff at the time of Roswell, Chief of Staff of the Army, would have been General Dwight Eisenhower. At 23:32 Mountain Standard Time, 3 July 1947, radar stations in East Texas and White Sands Proving Ground tracked two unidentified aircraft until both dropped off radar. And then there's a lot of information about debriefings, discussions with radar operators at various sites, not only in Texas and New Mexico, but also as far away as Fort Monmouth in New Jersey, about the unidentified flying objects that were seen painted on radar over New Mexico. This report was dated 22 July 1947. When you scroll down to point 6 in this report, and it says, a special radiobiological team accompanied by a SED, that's Special Engineering Detachment from Armed Forces Special Weapons Project at Sandia, and security detail from Sandia Base under orders from Colonel S.V. Hasbrook, United States Army Armed Forces Special Weapons Project, secured the immediate area surrounding the crash site. Select scientists from the General Advisory Committee, the GAC, of the Atomic Energy Commission, most notably Dr. J. Robert Oppenheimer, was identified at LZ2, that's a landing zone 2, as well as other members. Among paperclip specialists identified at LZ2 were Dr. Werner von Braun from Fort Bliss, Dr. Ernst Steinhoff, Air Material Command, and Dr. Hubertus Strughold, Aeromedical Lab, Randolph Field. Randolph Field was in Texas. Because of the stringent security measures that were in place at both crash sites, the team was not able to gain access to the several locations where wreckage and bodies were held. CIC, that's Counterintelligence Corps member of the team, was able to learn that several bodies were taken to the hospital at Roswell Army Air Force and others to either Los Alamos, Wright Field, Patterson Air Force, Army Air Forces, and Randolph Field for security reasons. It is believed that this dispersion was on the orders of General Thomas Handy, 4th Army Headquarters. Remains of the power plant and something illegible were taken to Alamogordo AAF and Kirtland AAF. Structures and assorted illegible taken to Air Material Command Wright Field. Other remains were illegible to the storage facilities of the Naval Research Lab, NRL. All this was accomplished by 1730 Mountain Standard Time, 7 July. That's 1730, that's 5:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, 7 July. On 7 July, Lieutenant General Nathan Twining arrived at Alamogordo Army Airfield for a secret meeting with Army Air Force Chief of Staff Spots and to view recovered remains of craft from LZ-2. Now, this is important. General Nathan Twining, at the time, was commander of Air Material Command at Wright-Patterson, what became Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. It was the center of Air Force development, aerospace development, was there at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Air Material Command. Beneath AMC are all these other divisions, T2, T3, that we'll talk more about, as well as the Foreign Technology Division. Tui Spots, Tui was his nickname, was the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. He succeeded General Henry Arnold for the position of Chief of Staff of the Air Force. So we're talking about two major league players here. On 7 July, Lieutenant General Nathan Twining arrived at Alamogordo Army Airfield for a secret meeting with Army Air Force Chief of Staff Spots and to view recovered remains of craft from LZ-2. On 8 July, Twining visited Kirtland Army Air Force to inspect parts recovered from power plant. When they refer to Alamogordo Army Airfield. That's what later became known as Holloman Air Force Base, which is infamous in our field of UFO studies. It is the alleged location of not just one, but a number of meetings between aliens and high-level members of the U.S. government, including apparently General, later President Dwight D. Eisenhower. On 7 July, Lieutenant General Nathan Twining arrived at Alamogordo AAF for a secret meeting with AAF Chief of Staff Spots and to review recovered remains of craft from LZ-2. On 8 July, Twining visited Kirtland Army Airfield to inspect parts recovered from power plant. On 9 July, Twining and staff flew to WSFG. I can't really read that part, to inspect pieces of craft being stored there. And on 10 July, made inspection of R&D facilities at Alamogordo and then returned to Wright Field. I believe refers to the weapons special program at Sandia. It is believed that Twining and staff is preparing a detailed report of both incidents and briefings later to follow. It is the belief of Counterintelligence Corps, CIC, that General Eisenhower will see a showing of recoveries sometime in late August this year. Well, that first part there is somewhat illegible. The president was given a limited briefing at the Pentagon by Acting Chief of Staff, Army Air Forces General Hoyt Vandenberg. While Spots was in the field, not only going to New Mexico, but other places where there was a high level of activity of aliens and UFOs, General Hoyt Vandenberg, the aforementioned Hoyt Vandenberg, was in Washington, D.C., the Pentagon, that area, as acting chief of staff. And here's a bit of corroborating information. A close colleague of General Hoyt Vandenberg was General Loris Norstad, and that goes back to World War II. Norstad was a major player as a staff officer, and he later became the commander of NATO, the four-star general commanding NATO, where he wanted NATO to become a nuclear armed power. What's interesting is I've read other documents about this, about how at the time of Roswell, Norstedt and Vandenberg were monitoring reports coming out of New Mexico for the Air Force. But as fate would have it, my late great mentor, Barbara Bartholik, and I think I've told this story before, but it bears repeating. She was at the dentist's office and she met an elderly gentleman there. They began talking, and Barbie mentioned she was into UFO alien abduction research. The elderly gentleman said to her, "Well, that's interesting because I used to work on General Loris Norstad's staff, and at the time of Roswell, we were getting reports about the crash retrieval of the alien craft at New Mexico, in and around Roswell and other places, Corona. There are a number of sites that were identified. There was not just one crash site." So, interesting bit of corroborative information. Decades down the track, this elderly gentleman, who by that point probably had nothing left to lose and wasn't in any fear of the government anymore, confided to Barbie that he was on General Loris Norstad's staff. Norstedt closely connected to General Hoyt Vandenberg. Norstedt was receiving updates on what was going on at Roswell. Very interesting. Continuing, the president was given a limited briefing at the Pentagon by Acting Chief of Staff, Army Air Forces General Hoyt Vandenberg. Something illegible. FBI interest was curtailed, and access to stored craft at Los Alamos was denied upon request of Deputy Chief of Staff of the Army, Lieutenant General Collins. Collins later became Chief of Staff of the Army. For those of you who don't know, General Joseph Collins, known as Lightning Joe from World War II, he was the commander, if memory serves, of the 25th Infantry Division, so-called Lightning Division, in the Pacific. And then he later became a corps commander in the European Theater of Operations, 7th Corps. In fact, it was the 7th Corps that led the breakout out of Normandy. In the western part of Normandy, Operation Cobra. That's another story. But General Collins, here in this story, refused permission to the FBI to gain access to the recovered craft. And you can see this in future documents later, where Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, is complaining in some of his memos about the Army's refusal to allow the Bureau to inspect recovered craft. So there's a basis for what's being described here. Inquiries to bases involved was restricted by General Vandenberg during the duration of recovery efforts. All teletype, telephone, and radio transmissions were monitored for any disclosures of the finds. To maintain secrecy at Site LZ2, the CO of Roswell Army Airfield was authorized to give a brief press release to local paper in which 8th Air Force Headquarters promptly denied rumors that the Army had flying saucers in their possession. That was the old bait and switch, which we are now familiar with. The base media officer at the time, Lieutenant Walter Hott, came forth with the press release that the Army had recovered a flying disc at a ranch near Roswell. And then that story was refuted and debunked essentially by the parent organization of the 509th Bomb Group, which was the 8th Army, 8th Air Force, rather, at Carswell Field, Fort Worth. General Roger Ramey, who was key player in the 8th Air Force in World War II, memory serves, but also he commanded one of the B-29 wings, first in India, China Theater, and then later in the Marianas Islands under General Curtis LeMay. Again, we're not pulling these names out of a hat. Continuing, the report goes on to state, to maintain secrecy of Site LZ2, the commander, the CO of Roswell Army Airfield, was authorized to give a brief press release to a local paper in which 8th Air Force Headquarters promptly denied rumors that the Army had flying saucers in their possession, which effectively killed press interests. Civilians who might have seen or handled some of the wreckage or viewed bodies were detained under the McNab Law until all remaining evidence was secured in restricted bases. Witnesses were debriefed by CIC, that's Army Counterintelligence Corps, and warned of the consequences of talking to the press. So far, secrecy seems to be working. Point number nine, this is interesting. All civilian and military personnel involved with the recovery operation had, quote, need to know, unquote, access with proper security clearances, though several MPs suffered nervous breakdowns, resulting in one committing suicide. Something like that happened at in the aftermath of Rendlesham Forest, where, according to Larry Warren, one of the witnesses, security personnel, Air Force security personnel, was so troubled by what he'd seen and endured, poor guy committed suicide. Continuing, MP details from Alamogordo and Kirtland performed security functions very well. Ground personnel from Sandia experienced some form of contamination, resulting in the deaths of three technicians. The status of the fourth technician is unknown. Autopsies are scheduled to determine cause of death. CIC has made appropriate security file entries into dossiers with cross references for future reviews. In other words, and they probably went to some length to doctor or launder the deaths of those people in certain official memoranda, but in the real files, they'll list what happened to these guys. Point number 10, with the pending approval of James Forrestal as new Secretary of Defense, it is certain that he will be briefed on certain aspects of the discoveries. James Forrestal became Secretary of Defense. Before that, he was Secretary of Navy, and he was an original charter member of Majestic 12, who was later suicided outside of a window at Bethesda Naval Hospital. That's another story, but it's related. It is certain that he will be briefed on certain aspects of the discoveries. The only cabinet member to date that may know of the details is Secretary of State Marshall. It has become known to CIC that some of the recovery operation was shared with Representative John F. Kennedy, Massachusetts Democrat elected to Congress in 46. Senator, son rather, of Joseph P. Kennedy, Commission on Organization of the Executive Branch of the Government. Kennedy had limited duty as naval officer assigned to naval intelligence during the war. It is believed that information was obtained from sources in Congress who was close to Secretary for Air Force. Point number 11. As to the bodies recovered at LZ2, it appeared that none of the five crew members survived entry into our atmosphere. Well, that contradicts information from other sources that there was a survivor. Again, Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit is only going by what information they had access to. So if they had no need to know or see a living alien who survived the crash or crashes, then they didn't have a need to know that. They're only reporting what they have knowledge of. As to the bodies recovered at LZ2, it appeared that none of the five crew members survived entry into our atmosphere due to unknown causes. Dr. Detlev Bronk has been asked to assist in the autopsy of one well-preserved cadaver to be done by Major Charles Rhea. From what descriptions the team was able to learn and from photographs taken by intelligence photographers, the occupants appear in most respects human with some anatomical differences in the head, eyes, hands, and feet. They have a slight build, about 5 feet tall, with grayish pink skin color. They have no hair on their bodies and clothed with a tight-fitting flight suit that appears to be fireproof. Some of the bodies looked as if they'd been burned on the head and on hands. Their overall stature reminds one of young children. It is believed that there were male and female genders present, but it was hard to distinguish. Check this out. Point number 12. The most disturbing aspect of this investigation was there were other bodies found not far from LZ1 that looked as if they had been dissected as you would a frog. It is not known if Army field surgeons had performed exploratory surgery on these bodies. Animal parts were reportedly discovered inside the craft at LZ2, but this cannot be confirmed. The team has reserved judgment on this issue. Point number 13. Our assessment of this investigation rests on two assumptions. One, either this discovery was an elaborate and well-orchestrated hoax made by the Russians, or two, our country has played host to beings from another planet. Point number 14. Until more data can be acquired from other intelligence sources, it is the opinion of the team that the investigation be expanded to include sources that might elucidate other possibilities not found by contemporary science. It is also recommended that appropriate budgets be allocated to facilitate future assignments that the unit may be called upon to perform. Until further orders, this investigation will continue. End of report. A fascinating report from the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit that was there on site after, in the aftermath of the retrievals. IPU being a branch of the Science and Technology Directorate of the Army Counterintelligence Corps. Quite a lot to unpack there. Particularly troubling, as pointed out in the report, were the remains found of what seemed to be dissected or vivisected body parts. They didn't specify that human body parts were found, but they did mention that animal remains were found on board the craft. We know that cattle, elk, other animals have been brought on board and have been harvested for their body parts, internal organs, bodily fluids, glandular secretions, etc., etc. So that aspect of the report in itself should be troubling as far as what the ulterior motive of the beings, at least those found at the crash sites in New Mexico in June, rather July 1947. And again, it must be stressed, this was one of a series of crash retrievals in that time frame. The infamous alien autopsy footage was shot by a intelligence cameraman sent specifically by General Tuohy Spots and other high-ranking members. That crash retrieval and those bodies were actually recovered in May 1947. So it was actually before what became known as the Roswell event. There was a series of crash retrievals. And then in 1948, March 1948, we had the Aztec New Mexico crash retrieval in March 1948, which I'll get into at some other time. There is another report, this one dated 2 September 1947, from the Research and Development Laboratory Analytical Report. Subject flying saucer to the Commanding General Air Materiel Command, Wright Field, Dayton, Ohio, and that is General Nathan Twining, Commander of Air Materiel Command at that time. And also, it lists one of the other addressees as Brigadier General Charles Cabell, Headquarters Army Air Forces. And that's a very interesting individual as well, because Brigadier General Cabell later became Deputy Director of the CIA, and his brother, coincidentally, Earl Cabell, was mayor of Dallas at the time of JFK's assassination. So We're not even talking 6 degrees of separation here. This message was directed to General Charles Cabell, who became the head of Air Force Intelligence, later became deputy director of the CIA while still in the Air Force. And his brother was the mayor of Dallas and had some authority, control, connection with the police and law enforcement in Dallas. It makes for an interesting hypothesis that when the decision was made to assassinate JFK, here is a guy, General Charles Cabell, who had direct firsthand knowledge of the retrieval of alien technology and alien bodies. And the notion that JFK wanted to go public, at least in part, with the reality of the alien presence on planet Earth and share that information and do it in conjunction with the Soviets, this was a line that couldn't be crossed. So just keep that point in mind. At the time of Roswell, the commander of the Air Force Research and Development branch was none other than General Curtis LeMay. This was before LeMay was transferred to head up the U.S. Air Force in Europe. So let me read from this analytical report dated 2 September 1947. As requested by a letter of 16 July 1947, this office has produced its conclusions on the manufacture, function, and possible origin of the above referenced subject. On-site preliminary study data provided by personnel of T2 and T3, search and recovery team of the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project, paperclip personnel, select personnel of the Army Air Force's scientific advisory group, headed up by the aforementioned Dr. Theodore von Karman, and personnel of the Atomic Energy Commission Advisory Committee. That's the General Advisory Committee of the Atomic Energy Commission, headed up by J. Robert Oppenheimer at the time, was utilized in the construction of our analysis. The analysis of the Office of Research and Development are aerodynamics and design evaluation studies performed by the aircraft, power plant, and propeller laboratories of Engineering Division T3 personnel has concluded that some nation has reached a stage of flight development in which the present ideas are entirely obsolete. That's point A. Point B, a notable advance in reducing drag and high lift wing load is evident in the cleaned up refinement in the extreme. The absence of riveting and surface overlapping indicates a simplistic concept that confronts our technology to match the careful and well-considered compromises in respect to weight, aerodynamic refinement, and design. And you will come across this again and again. I'm going to read later from the White Hot Report issued under the Air Materiel Command under General Twining. And again, the authors of the report convey their bewilderment at the lack of what they consider at the time state-of-the-art aerodynamic engineering. Continuing, point C, the designers have managed to offset Bernoulli's theorem that allows the, quote, total pressure in a flow, unquote, to be less at all points. We can liken this to the concept of conservation of energy, and they're negating friction losses, which would dissipate heat. Airfoil design of the circular wing is similar to the NACA 230 series, with the exception to the wing plan form and thickness range requirements. The parasite drag appears to be controlled by the refinement of the design and elimination of protuberances. The induced drag lessens with the circular span inversely with a low aspect ratio of the wing. Very technical. This is, after all, written by the Research and Development Lab of Air Force Research and Development. Point E, the fuselage hull appears to fall into the seaplane type in concept by manifesting excellent hydrodynamic characteristics of low porpoising tendencies. Conventional surface controls are absent in the wing and cabin portions of the recovered sections, though what appears to be tabs or flaps are identified. Because there are no vertical or horizontal stabilizers on the craft, there are no fore and aft positions of the wing relative to the fuselage hull. In other words, there is no, for all intents and purposes, there is no front and back of the craft. Wing incidence seems to be pre-selected via an in-flight trim computer to reduce drag attitude when the wing is at the angle of attack required at high speed and provide stability to lift the weight of the craft. Basic letter from R&D to CG, AMC, Attention Headquarters, Army Air Forces, Washington, D.C., Acting Chief of Staff, Air Force Intelligence, Magic Eyes, Subject Flying Saucer. F, point F, a general description of the craft is presented. Point one, metallic skin of a high polished finish. A comparison of AISI H111-12 steels indicates that the metals used to construct the craft exceed structure, chemical composition, and mechanical properties currently under development. And then they list all these different types of metals that they're comparing it to, which they got negative results from. Point two, craft designed for high altitude flight. Automatic exhaust orifices were identified. A gyro-controlled wing stabilizer apparently maintains craft in a hover mode. Point three, power plant may consist of a spherical reactor, hydrogen isotope type, connected to propulsion motors. Point four, 100 feet in diameter with central section approximately 30 feet. Central cabin may have three flight decks. Remember, Bob Lazar talked about how there were three flight decks within the sport model. Not saying it's the same thing being reported here. I'm not saying there's a universal design at work, but did mention that the sport model had three levels. 100 feet in diameter with central section approximately 30 feet. Central cabin may have three flight decks. Top level for flight control, central section for equipment, and lower section for power plant and landing gear. Circular wing may have rotating section and adjustable leading edge. Many eyewitnesses have seen craft, top section, lower section, rotating. Okay, we've seen this before. Point five, top dome may have the ability to recede into central section for high performance operations. In other words, flatten itself out, make it more aerodynamic. Observation blisters are retracted to provide observation top and bottom of wing. Construction is based on a 6-to-1 ratio. Flight instruments and controls are activated by optical waveguide fibers, similar to glass rods, except they are flexible and have a plastic cladding wrap. All functions may be operated by touch-sensitive or texture-sensing stimuli. Instruments are covered by a plastics plate and seem to be color-coded. That was point seven. Point eight, craft may have all-weather navigation capability to allow blind flying, possible television viewing used. Very interesting report. To round out this segment, I'm going to read from the White Hot Report sent out by Air Materiel Command under General Nathan Twining. This was dated 19 September 1947. I'll try to keep this brief because I don't want this part one to be prohibitively too long, because attention spans being what they are, we want to give people the opportunity to fully digest this. Interesting how the members are listed, and I'll talk a little bit about the membership of this particular committee. It lists a number of people, some of whom I've never heard of, but some of them I have. Major General Stephen Chamberlain, he was the operations officer under General MacArthur, Southwest Pacific Command. MacArthur, as was his wont, took credit for the bypassing strategy of bypassing strongly held Japanese islands and coastal bases in favor of attacking weakly defended areas, developing air bases for which to provide air cover for the next jump, the next leapfrog, so to speak. Well, the bypassing strategy was developed by the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington, D.C., and the Pentagon, and Major General Stephen Chamberlain, who was a colonel in World War II, was the one who put the bypassing strategy into operation. Major General Stephen Chamberlain later became director of Army G2, and I'll talk more about G2 later. Some of the other names are Rear Admiral Paul F. Lee, who was the director of the Office of Naval Research, ONR. We have Major General George McDonald, who became the director of Air Force Intelligence in October 1947. And during World War II, he held high-level posts as an intelligence officer with the 8th Air Force and also with the 12th Air Force. And in 1944, in February 1944, he was director of intelligence at U.S. Strategic Air Forces in Europe. And he must have, in my view, been exposed to the many, many reports of unidentified flying objects, Foo Fighters, et cetera, that pilots and air crews on all sides were seeing during World War II. Another name that jumped out at me was General Edwin K. Wright. General Wright was an intelligence briefing officer on the staff of General Omar Bradley, for the 12th U.S. Army Group in Europe during World War II. He became executive director of the Intelligence Division, U.S. Army General Staff in the War Department, under General George C. Marshall. And on General Bradley's recommendation, Wright became deputy G2 under then Army Air Forces Major General Hoyt S. Vandenberg. Wright was promoted to Brigadier General on February 3, 1947, and he became the first deputy director of Central Intelligence, serving under both General Hoyt Vandenberg and his successor, Admiral Roscoe Hayland-Cotter. Secretary of Defense James Forrestal injected General Wright into interagency disputes over which department was to direct black activities under clandestine operations. General Wright insisted that the CIA was and had to be the sole agency to conduct organized foreign clandestine operations. In 1949, Wright was assigned to General Douglas MacArthur's G3 Operations Staff at Headquarters, Far East Command. So once again, we have a guy who was a major player. And look at the names. He was closely associated, General Edwin K. Wright, with General Hoyt Vandenberg, Admiral Roscoe Hayland-Cotter, respectively the second and third directors of Central Intelligence, both charter members of the Majestic 12. He interacted directly with Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, who was also a member of Majestic 12. General Vandenberg expanded upon Admiral Sidney Sauer's development of Central Intelligence. Vandenberg pulled in all these resources. I don't have the time to get into it, but if there was any one general individual who made Central Intelligence what it is today, it was Hoyt Vandenberg. But his predecessor, Admiral Sidney Sauers, like I said before, I think I mentioned this, wound up becoming Executive Secretary of the National Security Council and was deeply involved and highly influential in developing the CIA's clandestine capability. And then General Edwin K. Wright winds up on the staff in operations for General Douglas MacArthur, another person who was known to be deeply interested in UFOs and alien craft. And in conjunction with General George C. Marshall, the co-creator essentially of the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit. And of course, years later, General MacArthur went public about his fears of an eventual alien invasion. So these are some of the heavy hitters that we've seen on some of these committees, according to these documents, along with the aforementioned individuals, General Stephen Chamberlain, General Edwin K. Wright, General George McDonald. We also have listed for this particular committee report Dr. Theodore von Karman and General Leslie Groves, Dr. J. Robin Oppenheimer, and Dr. Doolittle, Dr. James Harold Doolittle, the great Air Force general, but in his capacity as a Shell Oil executive in research and development and technical issues. So it was quite an august body of individuals that made up this committee, and there were others, but I don't have time to get into them. Now, let me delve into some of the key points of this white-hot report. And oh, yes, Professor Albert Einstein was also part of this committee. This report is dated 19 September 1947, the White-Hot Report. Part one, and I skipped down a ways to get to some key points. Part one, Project White Hot Intelligence Estimate, Preliminary, Landing Zone Number One, Socorro, New Mexico. The unidentified lenticular-shaped aerodyne, which has been designated ULAT-1, unidentified lenticular-shaped aerodyne, ULAT-1, has been evaluated as a non-air-breathing aircraft of unknown origin, totally lacking conventional wing, fuselage, nacelle, central and fuel system, strongly indicates it is not Russian. Boy, howdy. Consultation with paperclip specialists concur. Aerodynamic features exhibited in ULAT-1 represents a very high degree of engineering and sophistication not seen in this country. Dimensional homogeneity study cannot explain how this craft sustains lead and lift factors necessary for flight. The power plant does not even remotely resemble any conventional type now in use. Lacking any discernible intake or exhaust features, it is the opinion of AMC Air Materiel Command at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and ONR, Office of Naval Research, that this craft was designed to operate outside of the Earth's atmosphere. In other words, outside of the Earth's atmosphere in outer space. The unconventional conclusions reached by members of this fact-finding mission remain tentative at this time. Some members expressed the view that ULAT-1 may be the product of an advanced culture from another planet that is much older than ours and has utilized the science and intellect for interplanetary space travel. It is not precisely known if the occupants purposely had the objective of exploration out of curiosity or with the intent of surveying for other reasons. So far, no hostile action or intent has been observed since they made their presence known. Given the fact that our atomic bomb tests, atmospheric exploration with rockets, and conducted, I'm guessing that's a word there, in New Mexico, could have precipitated the events that led to the incident and subsequent actions taken by the military. Operating under the assumption that the fallen object was a long-range Russian reconnaissance platform collecting aerial photographic intelligence data, military intelligence personnel were instructed to secure the craft, debris, and occupants as rapidly as possible. Concerns over possible exposure to civilians of unknown biological and chemical agents dictated the quarantine measures taken. Radiation hazards were assumed and appropriate protective measures were taken as well. In the interest of national security priorities, it was necessary to detain civilian witnesses for interrogation to satisfy intelligence requirements and quash rumors that may alert potential espionage agents known to be in the vicinity. And there were definitely espionage agents in New Mexico and other places throughout the desert Southwest. Several bodies were discovered. Because on-site medical personnel were unsure of the physiological and biological makeup of the occupants, special preparations and preservation methods were employed. Autopsy information obtained so far suggests that the occupants mimicked the features associated with redacted, but next to it in writing, someone wrote Orientals. Outwardly, they appear human-like, with but one exception. Autopsy notes mention a rarely observed redacted present, which supports the premise that these beings originate from another planet. Part 2, Technical Evaluation Preliminary. ULAT-1. Upon close examination of the exterior surfaces of the craft's fuselage, metallurgists found the skin to be of a ferrous metal white in color. The metal exhibits all the characteristics of a high-grade steel. It was determined that the steel was cold-formed and heat-treated. Tensile strength was estimated in excess of 150,000 pounds per square inch. Shear tests give the metal a durability rating above 175,000 pounds per square inch, making this fuselage extremely strong and heat-resistant. Point number two, static and pressure flow simulations were impressive. The low profile ratio of 6:1 gives the aerodyne a great advantage in overcoming the restrictions of the boundary layer effect in high performance operations. Quick point. Dr. Theodore von Karman was one of the world's leading experts in wind tunnels. And we know that some of the wind tunnels that were used to experiment with recovered alien craft took place in Langley, Virginia, Langley Air Force Base, which is quite near what later became the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, and other places. They actually put recovered craft in these wind tunnels, cranked up the wind, and observed how these craft operated or how they performed in wind tunnel conditions. Okay, continuing. Point three, spar flanges are constructed in unusual kinematic design, which is believed to allow strain relief at supersonic speeds. There were no visible signs of plate stiffeners. There were no fasteners, welds, rivets, or fittings holding the fuselage together. Bob Lazar talked about this, as well as others, that when he was inside the central part of the craft and he looked at everything, there were no edges. Everything was rounded. It seemed to him that the interior of the craft had been mold injected. And we heard something like this from some of the early contactees, which mainstream nuts and bolts type investigators, I think of NICAP and some of those types of civilian, supposedly, research organizations, they went out of their way to push the nuts and bolts hypothesis. But there were some contactees who stated that they were told by the aliens that they interacted with or were taken up on trips with, because that used to happen in the old days, where especially the human-looking aliens would land, give somebody a ride, show them around, give them a tour, etc., etc. Well, some of the early contactees were told that some of the craft, alien craft, are created in what amounts to a chemical bath, and that as the mold begins to grow, the parts inside and outside begin to differentiate, and then eventually it becomes a completed, intact, whole, homogeneous craft. And that may explain in part why there doesn't seem to be any welds, fasteners, rivets, anything seemingly holding not just the fuselage together, but the whole craft together. And the phenomenon that Lazar observed, that the inside of the craft looked like it had been mold injected. There was no sharp edges. Everything was kind of smooth and rounded. Parts of it were rounded. Very interesting. Point four, lack of wings, flap stabilizers, and surface central features suggests that the craft is a lifting body. Five, there are no air intakes or exhausts. Six, there are no cables. Seven, there are no identifiable electronics, wiring, ignition, lights, instrument compartment, engine, meters, vacuum tubes, solenoids, generators, heaters, etc. The power plant severely damaged, redacted, neutronic engine, redacted, detected heavy water and deuterium light hydrogen elements here to be the primary igniter. A series of coils and heavy magnets connected to the neutronic engine via an oddly arranged group of electrodes, metal not yet identified, appears to be the directive force or something, reactive force or active force, if that part is illegible. One small motor was examined. It is encased in a pure aluminum capsule directly underneath the main engine compartment. Moving on to point nine. Navigation and engine controls may be activated by tactile manipulation. Viewing may have been achieved by a form of television imagery. Symbolic notation appears to be the form of flight and control indicators. Flat panels of unknown metal has been suggested as a device associated with the operation of the aerodyne was discovered and analyzed. Its mode of operation and purpose is unknown. The absence of provisions, berthing compartments, and storage areas suggest the notion that this craft may be a short-range reconnaissance platform. Continuing, mode of operation is believed to be instrumentation and suggests that the aerodyne, from reconstruction of available wreckage, redacted, biosensory and optical stimuli for these reasons. Absence of indicator lights, absence of any circular dials, absence of linear dials or moving pointers, absence of counters, absence of scopes. Moving down to point 16, and we're getting to the end, point 18 rather. The following elements were analyzed and found to exist in the small neutronic power plant that was found inside ULAT-1. A. UF6 in metallic form. B. Hydrogen fluoride gas. C. Water and uranium tetrafluoride. D. Powdered magnesium and potassium clarate. E. Metal similar to lead with a chocolate brown color. F. U-235 in metallic form. That's uranium-235 in metallic form. G, plastic-like material similar to Ne102. H, beryllium. I, pure aluminium. H, thorium isotope material. J, plutonium powder. Scientists from Los Alamos and Sandia were alarmed that the power plant could possibly function as a bomb if the elements described above were processed in similar fashion as was done for the lens and shotgun detonators. They're referring to the lens implosion device of the plutonium Fat Man device and the shotgun or the gun barrel type detonator used to set off the uranium 235 Hiroshima device. This originally was the first conclusion. After further evaluation, it was determined that since no recognizable firing circuits were identified, the threat of detonation did not exist. Point 20. The only evidence of circuitry found on the motor was thin plastic light sheets fashioned like platters embossed on the exterior of the spherically shaped casing coated by a thin film of pure silver. Under high power magnification, it was observed a series of fine grid-like lines intersecting groups of dots arranged in circular patterns. Part 3, scientific probabilities. Point 1, based on all available evidence collected from recovered exhibits currently under study by Air Materiel Command, Armed Forces Special Weapons Project, NEPA, Atomic Energy Commission, Office of Naval Research, NACA, Joint Research Development Board, that's the Joint Army Navy Research and Development Board, which after a number of name changes down the years, we now know as DARPA. RAND was specifically set up at the behest of General Henry Arnold, along with other notable individuals. Dr. Theodore von Karman, I believe, played a role in that, as did General Curtis LeMay. USAAF SAG, that's United States Army Air Forces Scientific Advisory Group, headed up by the aforementioned Dr. Theodore von Kammen, and MIT, who was the dean of MIT, Dr. Vannevar Bush, are deemed extraterrestrial in nature. So all those different agencies came to the same conclusion. This craft and the remains and the technology came from beyond our planet. There's all this talk about interdimensional this, interdimensional that, and we've talked about how some of these civilizations and beings, individual beings, have the ability to go from one dimension or another. What they've done is they've created this artificial fault line. I've talked about this many times before, but it bears repeating, that they try to divide this neatly into interdimensional vice extraterrestrial. They say that the interdimensional is more likely. Well, this craft, ULAT-1, and others like it, or maybe not exactly like it, but many others, were recovered on our planet in our dimension. So when we're talking about interdimensional, well, that's all well and good, but it was found in our dimension. And some of these craft are extraterrestrial. They do come from other star systems in our cosmos, in our plane of reality, in our dimension. That does not preclude the very likely possibility that some of these spacefaring civilizations have developed an interdimensional capability. They're two sides of the same coin. So let me reread that section there. Based on all available evidence collected from recovered exhibits currently under study by AMC, AFSWP, NEPA, AEC, ONR, NACA, JRDB, RAND, USAF, SAG, and MIT, are deemed extraterrestrial in nature. This conclusion was reached as a result of comparisons of artifacts redacted discovery in 1941, which can only be, in this context, in this country, America, be referring to Cape Girardeau, Missouri, 1941. And I've had Paul Blake Smith on my show talking at length about the crash retrieval in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, 1941. The technology is outside the scope of U.S. science, even that of German rocket and aircraft development. And we know that paperclip scientists and engineers were consulted. This is mentioned a number of times in these documents. And we know from what Clark McClellan told us that Wernher von Braun had admitted to Clark that he had been at Roswell and seen the alien wreckage. Wernher von Braun was not only mentioned in the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit report, but was also mentioned in the letter that Dr. Robert Sarbarker, the dean of the Washington Institute of Technology, sent to UFO researcher William Steinman. He specifically mentioned Wernher von Braun, as well as other scientists and physicists, Oppenheimer, Vannevar Bush, John von Neumann. Now, near the bottom of the report, we have an interesting mention of microcircuitry. In the arena of nuclear weapons, we feel there is a certain advantage to be gained, redacted. It is speculated by some that if reduced size and miniature circuitry were introduced into the proposed hydrogen bomb program, it would give U.S. Strategic Air Forces a great deterrence capability over the Russians. Current studies at MIT of microelectronics taken from ULAT-1 may give us the strategic advantage so desired. It is strongly recommended that funding be allocated in this area. So right there, it mentions as far back as 1947 that MIT, again, the dean of MIT was Dr. Vannevar Bush, and there were other people at MIT that were involved in UFO back engineering, research, inspections, evaluation, etc. Merle Tuve worked on radar, worked on the proximity fuse, airborne radar. If memory serves, Tuve was one of the team members that went on board the craft recovered in Aztec, New Mexico, March 1948. Another MIT scientist who was involved in some aspects of alien research, Dr. Luis Alvarez, who of course played a role in development of radar and also involved in the Manhattan Project. So MIT was involved from the very start as far as the back engineering of alien technology is concerned. And in this context, in this particular instance, I referenced a moment ago in microcircuitry. So if we ever wonder where a lot of this nanotech, microcircuitry, miniaturization, etc. came from, well, if these documents are anything to go by, this is pretty much where it started. The recovery of alien technology and the evaluation of said technology, particularly microcircuitry, in places like MIT. And over time, I'm sure they farmed it out to other places, the research and development of alien microcircuitry. Anyhow, I just wanted to run that all by you, and I hope that wherever you are, that you're having a very pleasant time. So for now, I bid adieu to the members of the public, and for those of you that are members of the Cosmic Switchboard Show, we'll see you at the top of the next segment. Bye for now.